action. So participation is definitely encouraged. This is an AMD Athlon 64 processor in a box for folks who want to build their own systems. So I'm really excited to be here today to talk about this project, this consolidation effort, which we called AMD on AMD. This is one of those projects where pretty much everything went right, and therefore it's a lot of fun to talk about. We had some great technology that worked pretty well. We had some partners that were very, very effective and very good to work with. And in general, it was quite a good story. Before I get into the specifics of that, though, I want to talk a little bit about... Wrong direction on the arrow. I want to talk, just give you a brief overview of kind of the context in which this is happening and talk a little bit about AMD for a moment. As you probably know, AMD designs and manufactures microprocessors. As of our very recent acquisition of ATI, we're also a leading producer of graphics processors. And I think in the future, you can start to look to see some combination and synergies between those two processor technologies. The company's been around since 69. We're based in Sunnyvale. Actually, this slide is a little bit old. It's 10,750 employees for AMD, but there's about 5,000 additional employees from ATI, so now we're a little bit over 15K. So we've got quite a bit of international sales. Revenue for 2005 is $5.8 billion and is certainly tracking well for 2006. It's a global enterprise. We've got presence in the Americas, strong presence in Europe, where all of our microprocessor front-end manufacturing exists, and then in Asia, where our back-end microprocessor manufacturing exists, and, of course, sales organization represented globally. And just a little bit about how the company's been doing, because this sort of leads into how we got into this project. We've had 12 consecutive quarters where the year-on-year microprocessor sales growth has exceeded 20%, which has really been quite good during those 12 quarters. We've got 26% of the x86 server share as of Q2, and 37% of the worldwide and 47% of the USA four-socket server business. And we now, this wasn't always the case either, but we now have kind of a full line of top-tier manufacturers using AMD processors in their products. And I mention all of this because times are quite good now at AMD. It wasn't always the case in kind of the 2002-2003 time frame. There were some pretty tough times there, and during that time we weren't making a whole lot of big investments in our IT infrastructure. And as a result, we ended up with quite a few servers that had aging technology, aging processors, processors of a nature that we didn't really want to have that much longer. So we started this AMD on AMD project with the goal of really running the company on AMD technology and showcasing the capabilities of the Opteron processor. So as I said, we had a lot of older servers that were near end of life, and even though these servers were based on older technology, they still were not terribly heavily utilized. We weren't getting great efficiency and utilization in those systems. They were not AMD Opteron-based. In fact, most of them were not even AMD-based. So we had a desire to modernize them and move to an AMD-based platform. Simultaneously, we had problems in the data center. Our main corporate data center is in Austin, Texas, and it's the same story I'm sure you've heard from a number of other people today. We were at the point where we were pretty much out of space, almost completely out of power, and even though we could probably have solved the space problem just with the shrinking of server form factors and higher density of servers, they really didn't address the power issue at all, and taking that approach, we were going to look at a significant investment in power infrastructure in the data center. So looking at doing this server consolidation project with virtual technology really addressed both of those issues. A couple of words about the IT team that did this project. IT globally has about 150 AMD employees. We also have a co-sourcing partner, HCL Technologies Limited in India. They provide most of the kind of operational services in the U.S. We have regional teams that support operations in the various regions, and they also support some regional specific solutions. and they participate in this project as well, as I'll explain a little bit later. So we have teams in the locations there, Austin, Sunnyvale, Dresden, Singapore, sites in Asia, Penang, in Penang, Suzhou, Frimley, and our latest site, which is really the corporate headquarters for ATI in Markham, Canada. So why did we decide to go virtual? As I said, there were other approaches that we could have taken to the problem. It's also possible to do server consolidation without using virtual technology, but it's quite a bit more difficult. It involves re-architecting applications to share servers. It limits your flexibility if you decide that these applications are going to go together on a server and you don't get the load quite right. Now you've got a lot more difficulty in unwedging those applications and moving them somewhere else. Since each server in that scenario is kind of custom built, it means that it's more difficult to recover those servers if you have a server failure. And it's really difficult to manage the resource consumptions across the multiple applications that you may have on those systems. So with virtualization, we could consolidate without having to clean up and do a whole lot of cleanup or re-architecting of our application environment. As I mentioned, some of our servers are old. Some of them are running old versions of operating systems. So we would have had the challenges of trying to upgrade those to, you know, operating systems that would even support the latest hardware. With the virtualization process, we were able to address those issues. We also were able to transform the physical servers really into commodity computing engines, especially with ESX 3.0. We keep no data that is of any value on the ESX hosts themselves. So if one of those servers fails or is having some type of significant problem, we just rebuild it rather than doing a lot of troubleshooting on it. Another benefit that we got from virtualization was that just by the fact that we built a redundant virtual infrastructure or a highly reliable virtual infrastructure, any machine that we moved into that infrastructure as a virtual machine inherited those capabilities. Most of our servers did not have high availability features or were not architected in a high availability manner, such as using clustering or hot standbys and all that kind of thing. So with this environment, even standalone servers that were originally single points of failure now have quite a variety of recovery and quick recovery capabilities in the ESX infrastructure. The other thing that this has helped greatly with is decreasing the time required for server provisioning. The AMD server provisioning process prior to virtualization, you know, involves getting approval for a purchase, getting a purchase order done, getting the thing delivered. You know, that could take weeks, if not, in some cases, months. Now it goes to minutes. Once it's approved, press a few buttons, and the virtual server is provisioned and made available for the customer. So our objectives here, we wanted to really showcase an enterprise-class virtual server environment based on the AMD Opteron processor. We wanted to obtain a lot of the efficiencies and benefits that I've been mentioning, so reduce power and space consumption. This was also a great opportunity to introduce some standard design and processes and tools that would be leveraged globally. Our initial focus was on the corporate data center in Austin, Texas, but from the beginning, we planned to extend this design as appropriate to the other facilities that had significant server installations. Those facilities over the years had kind of adopted some of their own processes, some of their own tools for managing the environment. With this design, we were able to take it and deploy it kind of simultaneously in all of these places using standard processes so that we can leverage each other's experiences in the environment. We can help to troubleshoot things if we have problems across the different environments, and just a much better way of having these regional teams that are supporting these different infrastructures work together. Certainly, we believe we get reduced per-server cost and labor requirements, improved resource utilization, the long litany of things that you really get as a benefit of virtualization. The last item on the list was important for us, elimination of non-AMD-based processors, as we really wanted to be able to show AMD running on its own technology. We started this effort We actually undertook it in December of 2005, and the goal was to complete this consolidation by the end of 2006, and we're certainly on track for that. We're done in the U.S. and soon to be done in the international sites. Virtualization, at least as implemented as a production service within IT, was definitely new to AMD. And we decided that in order for us to be successful and avoid any pitfalls that might exist in going down this path, that we would engage with a partner who had done this before and who could give us good advice in terms of how we should structure the environment, how we should manage it, et cetera. And it's actually at VMworld last year that we encountered RapidApp, who impressed us quite a bit with their approach to this type of problem, with their methodology. Shortly after VMworld, they came to Austin and talked to us, and we decided to engage them to help us with this undertaking. So they have a methodology that is essentially design, plan, and implement. So kind of in the design phase, they surveyed our server landscape in Austin. We provided a whole bunch of data, or all the data that we had, on current CPU utilization, CPU type, I/O rates, memory utilization, and all of those types of standard performance metrics. From that, we identified good candidate systems for consolidation. So factors that went into that were the type and the age of server. What was the resource utilization on the server? What benefits would it realize from virtualization, i.e., was it a server that was kind of a single point of failure today and would benefit from the improved redundancy that it would have in an ESX environment? So based on all of this, RapidApp came up with a paper design. I should say RapidApp and AMD working together came up with a paper design that would support the candidates that we had identified through this process. And we also spent quite a bit of time not just on technology, but on what were the processes that we were going to use to manage this environment. Because, again, virtualization was new to us. ESX as a technology was new to us. And we wanted to make sure that we carefully thought through, since we were going to be putting a fair number of production systems in this environment, what were our management processes and how are we going to maintain those systems in a production manner. In the planning stage, we kind of worked through this design. We agreed that this was the design that we wanted. So then RapidApp came back and worked with us, and the design phase was essentially about slightly less than a week's worth of work, actually, with RapidApp on site. And then they went off and worked on the design. Planning was much the same way. They came, we talked about, okay, what are the rules of how we can implement this? When can we have downtime? How long does it take to migrate a server? What resources do we have available? So we collected all that information. Then RapidApp kind of went off and put together a very detailed project plan of what they thought it would take to actually implement the design that we had come up with. The plan not only identified all the tasks, but it identified the various roles that were required to execute those tasks and the skill set that was required for each of those roles. So that then we had the option, when they came back with the plan, we said, okay, we've got these 8 roles here. We, AMD, can provide people to fill, these 3 roles. We'd like for you, RapidApp, to quote for us an engagement where you would provide folks to fill the remainder of the roles. So there was quite a bit of flexibility depending upon how many resources and what skill sets we had to put into the equation. As our methodology and in coming up with the timeline for the plan, we finally settled on putting together, having a standard migration window that would occur in the evenings, Austin time, on Monday through Thursday. So roughly 9 p.m. Austin time to 6 a.m. the following morning. We said those are going to be our migration windows, and when we start the migration processes, we're going to move a set number of machines each day during those windows. During the planning phase, we did not actually determine which machines we were going to move when. We just said this was going to be our general approach. What we ended up doing down the road was putting together a little website where the server or application owners could come and sign up for a time slot to have their machine migrated. They were all told they really didn't have a choice as to whether their machine migrated, so not participating was out of the question. And we said, look, come and get your time slot early so you can get the one you want. If you wait until the last minute, you might be stuck in a time slot that's less desirable for you. So implementation, again, was kind of broken up into several phases. We decided early on that we were going to go with ESX 3.0, which in the January 2006 timeframe was not available, not even released yet. But I'll talk a little bit more about why we decided to do that in a later slide. So based on that decision, we had a long period where we did process development. When as soon as we got beta code available for 3.0, we used that to develop management processes to test them out. We had to go back and revalidate them when the production code came out to make sure that nothing had changed. But we took that opportunity while ESX 3.0 was maturing to really work through those processes. As I mentioned, we chose to engage with RapidApp to provide some resources and expertise to complete the migration. I mentioned about the time slot for people could sign up. And we ended up, during this beta period for ESX 3.0, migrating about 25 carefully chosen non-production systems that we said there's minimal risk in doing this, and this would give us an opportunity to really flesh out our processes and prove to everybody who was concerned about moving to a virtual environment that this could really work. One other benefit that we had from this delay that was built into the project because of the availability of 3.0 was it was a great way to kind of push people back who heard that we were doing virtualization and all of a sudden wanted 10 servers by Friday, that they could have 10 virtual machines by Friday that they could start using. We sort of had two camps. We had those who said, oh, you know, my application's too special. It can't be in a virtual machine. And the other side was, wow, you can give me, a bunch of virtual machines right away. Sign me up. But we used that to say, look, we're not going to implement and give you any virtual machines on beta code. We're going to use this time to stabilize the environment, understand our processes, and when we're ready, we'll be happy to support your request with some caveats in terms of financial implications of that. So why did we choose 3.0 in that time frame? In fact, I remember some conversations early on with some folks from VMware where they were saying, you sure you don't want to go, just implement 2.5.2? But we wanted to do 3.0 because we thought we really had nothing to lose. We did not want to go through a significant implementation and consolidation and end up, at the end of it, running a version that we were going to have to turn around and upgrade in the fairly near term. We also, since we did not have a production VMware environment, we really didn't have a lot to worry about in terms of, okay, how are we going to migrate these existing virtual machines? We saw the risk of moving physical servers into 3.0 to be not significantly greater than moving them into 2.5.2. There were also some functionality that we wanted to see that we were getting from 3.0, some improved VMFS locking. There was all the improved automated recovery features that you get, and some capability to support larger memory sizes. Also, we knew that 64-bit was going to be coming, and that was going to show up in 3.0. So that was another reason we wanted it. The sizing of the infrastructure was based on some pretty detailed analysis that we did with RapidApp, based on all of the metrics that we had provided during the initial design phase. The good news is that as we went into implementation, I think some of us were surprised that it went as well as it did, but the analysis that we did really bore itself out in implementation. We had very few challenges where we had underestimated or gotten wrong the amount of resources that we needed to allocate to a virtual machine to allow a physical server to migrate. In a few cases where that did occur, it was because something significant had changed on the physical server between the time that we had really taken the metrics and sized the VM for it and the time that we actually did the migration. And in all cases, we were able to solve that quickly just by allocating some more resources to the VM. But we ended up going back and making a change in our process to kind of do a double check on the performance and resource profile of the physical servers right before we did the migration of those servers, just to double check the data that we had had from our previous analysis. So when it got to the matter of hardware selection, this is another area. We knew we wanted to use an AMD processor. RapidApp had advised us that AMD processors did an outstanding job running ESX 3.0. We didn't argue with that at all. And we talked about, what form factor of server should we use? And I would say, in this case, without a great deal of thinking or detailed analysis, we pretty quickly came to the conclusion that the four-processor dual-core solution was kind of a good fit for us. A couple of reasons for that. One, it's big enough where you can get a pretty decent consolidation ratio. With the size of VMs that we were migrating, we're looking at consolidation ratios. We plan for consolidation ratios in the area, plus or minus a few of 30 to 1 with that class of server. So it's big enough to support that type of consolidation. It's not so huge that you end up with a tremendous number of VMs on a single physical box, where even though you have automated VM recovery and all of those features, just the thought of, 60 or 80 VMs dying all at once if you happen to have a hardware failure, wasn't very appealing. Also, we thought it was a pretty good cost-benefit analysis. As you get into the larger servers and you start looking at the memory requirements in order to power enough VMs to fully utilize the CPUs on those larger servers, it starts to get quite a bit more expensive. You're using very high-density memory, and it just seemed like the four-processor box was an excellent balance between size versus cost versus risk. The other thing was that we had been using this particular box that we chose, which was the HP DL585. We'd been using it for some time as a traditional physical server and had an excellent track record with it. So we were very comfortable with that platform and decided to go with it. The 385, we had some VMs that we wanted to run in our internet DMZ, and we chose not to put those on our production farm, which was on our internal network. So we wanted to build a smaller farm in the DMZ, and the 385 was a good fit for the smaller number of VMs that we wanted to host in that environment. We looked at blades. We actually thought it would be very interesting to use blades. The reason we ultimately chose not to do blades was that, as you'll see when I get to the hardware slides, we wanted to build quite a bit of redundancy into the hardware design, and at least at the blades that were available at that time, there just simply weren't enough I/O slots in order to support all of the devices that we wanted to connect. Any questions? We have not. That's certainly something that we will evaluate, but we have been...
I'm sorry.
The question was, have we changed our philosophy on not using blades based on some recent announcements with blades that have a greater expandability? And the answer is no, we have not. Not that we are not open to doing that, but we have been focused... We sort of set on the design, and we've been focused on implementing the consolidation and not on upgrading the ESX infrastructure. When we get to the point where we're looking at another rev of ESX hardware or expansion of that environment, we may take a look at what hardware is available at that time. So AMD 64 technology, we thought that it was an excellent fit for our requirements, and some of the reasons that we think it works really well for virtualization as well as for other applications. 32 and 64-bit support. Now 64-bit support is available with the latest release of ESX. Also, great performance per watt. We had a power problem that we were trying to solve, and the Opteron really helped us to do that. The AMD virtualization technology that's being built into Opteron, we see as the partnership with VMware continues that will result in the highest possible virtual machine performance. And the Direct Connect architecture just allows the system to scale well and have a good balanced performance with access to I/O and memory. The specific configurations that we used for our ESX servers, for the 585, which was kind of our prime production server. It was a quad processor, dual core Opteron configuration, 48 gigabytes of physical memory in each box. We used two onboard gigabit NICs, and then we added some additional NICs to get the networking redundancy that we wanted. We had two single port fiber channel HBAs for our SAN connectivity. And again, as I mentioned, based on the size of the VMs that we were looking at, we could get anywhere between 24 and 38 VMs per host while still leaving 35% headroom on the host for unexpected load peaks. For the 385, smaller platform, smaller number of VMs that we wanted to support, it's a dual processor, dual core platform. We put 12 gigabytes of memory in them, two gigabit NICs, and then one external, two onboard NICs, and then one external NIC. The 385 includes some of the redundancy features of the 585, redundant fans and power supplies and things like that. We expect to get between 10 and 16 virtual machines on that platform. And this gives you an idea of the approach that we took to redundancy. So we had a number of different network segments that we connected these machines to. We had a production network segment. We dedicated two NICs to that. We had another network segment for test and development VMs. We chose to run test and development VMs in the same ESX infrastructure with production. We actually debated about this quite a bit when we did the design, but we did it ultimately for risk mitigation because we felt like, hey, look, if we put test and dev VMs with production VMs, we trust ESX that it's going to do the isolation that it's supposed to do to prevent the test and devs from consuming resources or running amok and impacting the production VMs. If we have a server failure because we have that mixture, now instead of having 30 production VMs down, we maybe have 15 or 20 production VMs down and the balance being test and dev VMs. The other thing is that a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times the test and dev VMs were less utilized than the production machines. So that enabled us to kind of drive, as opposed to like a really high consolidation ratio for test and dev on certain systems and then a lower consolidation ratio for production, we were able to balance that more across the farm with that approach. So anyway, we had the separate network for test and devs with two NICs dedicated to that. We had two NICs dedicated to the ESX server console, a separate link for vMotion, and then one free NIC available for any future expansion that we may want. And we spread those out across cards and PCI buses and things like that. On the SAN side, the two HBAs gave us redundant connections into a redundant SAN switch infrastructure, so we ended up with four paths to each SAN LUN. On the 385, a similar approach, just scaled down a bit. We had two NICs for a production network, one for the ESX console, one for vMotion, again spread across the various PCI slots and cards, and the same configuration for the SAN HBAs. So the networking was designed for automated failover. This is the configuration that the machines would be running in normally. And so you have a path that goes from, say, a production virtual machine into the ESX environment. If that path fails, falls away, and it is reestablished through an alternate path. Not sure what that first path graphics was the way it was. So beyond the technologies I mentioned, we thought a lot about the processes and procedures that we were going to apply to this environment. We really felt that it was important that we think that through in advance before we got into a situation where we had, 150 or 200 virtual machines and we didn't have a really solid backup approach or we didn't have a solid server provisioning approach. So some of the examples of the things that we designed during that initial phase while we were using the beta code, we automated the ESX server builds using Alteris as packaged by HP with their rapid server deployment. We went over in detail and documented the host and the virtual machine recovery procedures. We went through the processes for how we were going to patch and test both for the ESX host and for virtual center. we came up with a set of weekly and monthly preventive maintenance tasks that we were going to do on the virtual machine environment. We figured out our process for doing snapshots of VMs and looking at the service level agreement for snapshot delivery. Quality assurance checklists for hosts and VM builds. Even though it was automated, there's a series of checks that we would go through to make sure that they had built correctly. All the virtual machines, the construction of virtual machines is driven off of templates. So we went through the processes not only to build those templates, but how those templates got updated as patches to the templates were required. We thought about security and who was going to have access to the management tools and the ESX console. We thought about how we were going to monitor both the ESX hosts and the VMs that were running in them. And we also thought about the LUN provisioning process. I don't want to underestimate the SAN processes because certainly in our environment, as I think with most ESX 3.0 environments, the SAN is everything. The ESX hosts, they're commodities. They can be easily rebuilt, but the SAN is where everything lives, all the VM configurations, all the data. If that's not managed carefully, then you're going to have a problem at some point. So we here are the tools or the main tools that we use in this environment. You'll notice that we don't have a lot of really fancy third-party tools like plate spin and other tools. The main reason for this is not that we were opposed to them, but that at least in the time frame we were working, they weren't available for ESX 3. That's rapidly changing, and that's something that we're going to be looking at. But for the work that we've done for the migration, we've used the capabilities within ESX itself. We use Virtual Center to monitor the ESX hosts. We use HP OpenView to monitor the virtual machines, just as we did the physical machines that they came from. We are doing a classic backup scenario today. We're not using consolidated backup at this time, but that's on our list to go investigate. So we're running VeritasNet backup in the VMs to back up those machines. And we used Ultimate P2V for our P2V migration tool. Fairly straightforward, but it worked very reliably, worked well with ESX 3, and some of the more sophisticated tools, at least at the time that we began this, simply weren't available for ESX 3. So what did we achieve? If you looked at the original servers that we started with in Austin, 117 servers were consolidated to virtual machines running on 7 active ESX 3.0 servers, the DL585s. We also built 2 swing servers into the farm, i.e. servers that are more or less idle, but we use them for a couple of things. One, obviously if a active server fails, you've got that instant capacity to take over those VMs without impacting other servers. Secondly, the swing servers were a great place to introduce maybe a new VM into the environment. So again, we trust ESX's isolation capabilities, but by putting it on a swing server, we just have that extra bit of assurance at first. Once we're confident that the VM is behaving well, we can demotion it over to one of the active servers. The other great thing that the swing servers provide is when we encounter that scenario, which I think probably everybody who's used virtual servers encounters at some point, you migrate a machine to a physical machine to a virtual machine, and in a little while, maybe a week or so, the application owner comes and says, my application's having performance problems. I want you to move me back to my physical server. Well, what we do with the swing servers is before we say, okay, we're going to move this back to a physical server, we say, okay, well, let's see if we can get some facts and data here. We're going to move your virtual machine so that it's all by itself on this swing server over here. So now you've got, you've got 8 cores, 48 gigs of memory. We don't think you're going to be resource constrained. We'll make sure that the VM isn't resource constrained, and we'll see how the application behaves. And a lot of times we find that, oh, wow, it's still slow. I think maybe we better go look at what's going on in the application because there really doesn't seem like you've got a resource issue going on in the virtual machine. So, as I said, we consolidated 117 machines in Austin. Since that time and during the course of the project, we, as soon as we had the production code and the production processes in place, we opened up the environment so that people requesting new servers could get virtual machines as opposed to physical servers. So in addition to the 117 original machines that we consolidated, we've added new ones to bring the total in Austin up to 180, still on the same set of seven active servers plus the two swings. And then in Sunnyvale, much smaller environment, but we have 33 physical servers consolidated onto two ESX servers. We actually have way more capacity in Sunnyvale than we needed to support those 33, but we wanted room for growth, and we wanted to have at least two servers, obviously, for redundancy. Question? The one case that I can recall where we moved a server back to a physical server, we had moved a domain controller into a virtual machine, and the administrators for the domain, they ran a number of performance tests against the domain controller, which actually we had predicted with these particular tests and the nature of a domain controller and how ESX works, that it would probably perform less well as a virtual machine than as a physical machine in those particular tests. Sure enough, it did. Secondly, there was still some concern from the Active Directory team about the support that they were going to be able to get from Microsoft for Active Directory running in a virtual machine. So given those two factors, we never had a failure of the machine, and we never had real-world performance problems of Active Directory running in a VM. I would not stand up here and say, don't do it. We simply decided that, hey, if it wasn't that big a deal, we were gonna go ahead and move that back to a physical server. There was also a case where we moved an SAP development server to a VM, and there was a lot of pressure to move that back to a physical server, and we did not move that back. We actually did some analysis and found some issues in the SAP and database configuration that could be addressed and solve that particular problem. Plus, we did add some extra memory in the allocation for that virtual machine. So this graphic, you talk about these consolidation ratios, but it really hits home when you go walk around in the data center and you see, two rows of racks all of a sudden replaced by a single rack. It gets pretty dramatic. Power savings, this was one of the objectives that we had just from the perspective of avoiding an expensive power infrastructure upgrade. But the cost savings that we got, we calculated approximately a 79% reduction in power consumption. In the case of our Austin data center, that equates to about $69K per year. We estimate about $100K per year in power savings from the global AMD on AMD effort. Based on the figures that Diane was mentioning this morning, these estimates may be low. But certainly, we're confident that we're achieving at least this level of savings. We had done a financial model at the beginning of the project to kind of justify the investment. So there were a number of assumptions that we put into that model. So we focused on the Building 3 data center, in the main data center in Austin. We assumed a consolidation ratio of about 22 to 1, and we've definitely achieved that. We assumed that we would provide capacity for about 200 virtual machines, and that's what we did. We assumed that we were going to have, regardless of whether we virtualized or not, that we were going to undertake having a regular hardware refresh and a 3-year refresh cycle. Those were the main factors that went into the model. We also recognized that there would be an opportunity for further cost savings, both from power savings, as well as reduce support costs. But at the time that we did this model at the beginning of this project, we really weren't sure what those were going to be. So those were not actually factored into the actual calculations in the model. And in the financial analysis, we assumed an internal discount rate of 13%. And I'm not a finance guy, so don't ask me too many questions about exactly how the financial analysis worked. But we ended up with a 3-year net present value of $1.7 million. A payback period as compared to what we would have done if we had not virtualized of less than a year. So it became a no-brainer from a financial perspective for us to move forward with this. And some of the major contributions to the payback, in year one, we had this AMD on AMD goal to, you know, run the company on AMD. Had we had to do that all with physical servers, we would have bought a lot of physical servers to do that. In year two, had we not virtualized, we would have had to buy more physical servers for general expansion, plus we would have had to invest significantly in power infrastructure in the data center. And then in later years, the savings from the hardware refresh cycle start to kick in. So it became a pretty compelling financial story, at least based on our plans and assumptions. So the other benefits that we did achieve from this, we got improved redundancy for many systems. The standalone systems that had no failover before now had quite a bit of failover capabilities within the ESX farm. Automated recovery, which we had not had before in most cases. A great deal of flexibility in DR. I went to a session earlier today on an implementation of DR based around capabilities of ESX and SAN data replication. That we are not doing that yet in our environment, but that's something that we are definitely looking forward to doing in a phase two. And we think that the virtualization of systems and the elimination, the easy ability to restore systems on unlike hardware is going to be a great benefit to us in designing our DR solution. And also, and this was a big deal for us, we really made huge improvements in our standard management processes globally. We agreed on a consistent set of tools, consistent set of processes. And so now if you look at the infrastructure in Austin and the infrastructure in Dresden, it is essentially identical. Some next steps. As I mentioned, we're completing the rollout. We expect to complete that by the end of the year. With the acquisition of ATI, which we didn't even know about at when this project began, we are seeing a lot of opportunities to apply this within the ATI infrastructure. It turns out that ATI was suffering from many of the same problems that AMD was, especially in terms of space and power consumption. So we expect to replicate this design to some extent as required in those facilities as well. And looking at new capabilities, new tools, as things develop in the virtualization space, we'll certainly evaluate those and introduce those in a controlled fashion into the standard environment that we've built. One of the things that we've done in the past, as I mentioned, different teams would get excited about different technologies and decide, oh, we could implement this new backup solution. It's really great for our site, and then all of a sudden you have a different backup solution. So as we introduce those new capabilities, we again want to do that consistently on a global basis. So the conclusion is that this has been a great project for us. It's been very successful. Most of the people at AMD don't know that we've done it, which is really a good thing. Most of the application owners don't really know or care that much that their server is now a virtual machine. There certainly were no significant production interruptions that people would have remembered and associated with the project. It all went extremely smoothly from an implementation perspective. We have avoided having to do that power upgrade in Austin. We've achieved a lot of the expected benefits that we would achieve, especially in the improved manageability, reduced time to deploy a new server. Oh, one other thing about new server deployment. One thing that we ran into early on was, okay, people would say, look, now you can create a virtual machine for me, so you can give me as many as I want, and it's free, right? So we worked on, and we're still in the process of putting this in place, but we worked on a financial model whereby we kind of put a cost on a virtual machine or on ESX server resources. And so as people request machines for various functions, we charge that cost back to them, capture that money, and that goes into a pool of funds which can then be used to expand the ESX farm when it starts to run out of capacity. So unless you put some kind of gate on this, you know, people will rapidly get on board and come and say, yeah, I'd like 10 servers by Friday, please. You really have to have some controls around that to make sure that A, that's a reasonable request because people start to think, oh, they're just virtual machines. You know, there's no implications to creating as many of them as you want. But if you do that, then all of a sudden now you're overrun with virtual machines. You have potential operating system, licensing challenges. You still got all the management challenges of patches and so forth in the virtual machine. So it's important as you put this in to make sure that you have some controls around it to account for the financials and to keep it from just becoming a proliferation of virtual servers. Yes, question. We're still working on that model. So we've not had huge varieties in virtual machine sizes, but I expect that the final model will account for that in terms of, you know, there'll be so much cost for a, you know, some share of processor allocation, so much cost for memory allocation, and certainly cost for storage. Yes, question. Primarily Windows, of all varieties, everything from Windows NT up through Windows Server 2003. Yes, another question. The top pain point, I think, was getting the application owners on board. They didn't really have a choice because ultimately we had very strong management support and it was going to happen. But that still didn't prevent them from, you know, moaning and complaining and failing to sign up for a time slot for migration and, you know, blaming anything that went wrong on their server afterwards on the migration itself. So that was one pain point. Another one was that, ironically, the one major technical glitch that we ran into during the migration occurred not with the beta code, but with the production release of ESX3.0. We ran into an I/O performance problem when actually doing the P2V migrations, and worked. We had a 2 to 3 week delay in the project while we worked through that with VMware. We ultimately came up with a workaround, and I think they now have that problem patched. So those, and then the third one, I think, was more about, you know, setting expectations correctly, keeping things from getting out of control, getting too many things in virtual machines before we were ready. Like I said, we had that camp early on that as soon as they found out we were doing this, they started asking, oh, couldn't you just give us one virtual machine? You know, just one. You don't have to back it up or anything. You know, and we really tried to avoid doing that because we saw that was going to be a slippery slope. So those are our main challenges. Yes, another question, and with the orange shirt. Correct. Yes. Most of those machines, the original servers, again, these were, let me repeat the question. So the question was, looking at those 22 machines, what was the original memory footprint and how did that translate onto the ESX host? So the original memory footprint of most of these servers was in the 1 to 2 gigabyte range. These were older servers. You know, we didn't have the newer servers that we had, which had a lot more memory and a lot more processing power, we did not identify those as great candidates for virtualization. So those would be some of our large Exchange servers, large database servers, things of that nature. So these are mostly older machines that typically had 1 to 2 gigabytes of memory, and the memory footprint on ESX, it varied somewhat based on the actual utilization that we saw on those servers, but it would be in some cases half that amount, but so on average I would say a half to two-thirds of that amount that we actually allocated in ESX and found that performance was quite reasonable. Yes, I think you had a question.
Yeah, I wonder if you can speak a little bit more about the machines you decided that weren't good candidates, what was operating on them, what were the decision points you decided not to go forward with
the device? Okay. So the characteristics that would make a machine not a good candidate And this, again, was based around, this is not to say that we could not technically have virtualized those machines and been very successful with it, but based on the goals of the project, they didn't really fit the profile that we were going after. So a characteristic that would cause us not to virtualize a machine would be, number one, it had a high CPU or memory utilization, significantly larger than the figures I just quoted. Number two, it was already a relatively new physical server running on AMD technology. So part of the goal, as I mentioned earlier, was to eliminate non-AMD technology. So we focused on those servers as opposed to the ones that were already running, say, Opteron. Those are, I would say, the two. I guess the third one was we kind of shied away from machines that were already clustered. We just didn't want to deal with trying to decide what to do with that cluster configuration. And typically, those machines would have been not great candidates for the other two reasons I already mentioned. And lastly, if there was another project in flight that might have significant implications for a particular server, then we might shy away from messing with that server. For example, we run SAP. We're in the middle of an SAP upgrade. We're actually going to be running SAP all on all in native 64-bit mode. So any machine that was kind of tied up in the SAP project, we didn't consider a great candidate, first of all, because 64-bit at that time wasn't supported as a guest OS, and also we didn't want to have kind of two conflicting pulls on what to do with this server, one from the SAP side and one from our side. We said, okay, we'll go ahead and complete the SAP upgrade. We're going to use physical servers primarily for that, for the 64-bit reason, as well as for, in a lot of cases, capacity reasons. Once that, the dust has settled on that, we can look and see, okay, are there candidates for consolidation? That won't occur until sometime, probably after the mid-2007. Yes, question in the back. That's a great question. The question was, what was the nature of the applications that we were migrating? I would say that they were development environments for our major ERP system for SAP. We moved a number of development and test SAP environments. We had a number of departmental applications, small web servers, database servers, application servers, that were not corporate applications with high loads and high numbers of users, but applications that fit well within that profile. We had a number of small file sharing applications. In some cases, we virtualized those. In others, we simply consolidated those to a big file server cluster that we had. But it was typically smaller departmental level applications that were the type of thing that you would expect to find running on this older class of servers that we started with. Yes? We use the HP EVA 8000 for SAN. We have two EVA 8000 frames. We actually use one for all of the current production and development. The other frame we purchased as part of the requirements for beginning to implement a real DR solution for this environment. So our intent is to establish data replication between those two frames, have the other frame in a separate location, and be able to have the ability to recover the environment in that other location. Yeah, we haven't run into that, and part of that may be the workload of the machines that we've virtualized both in production and dev. certainly you'd have to look at what your IO rates are and how you manage the sand to make sure that you have the appropriate sand capacity to support that. But so far it's worked well for us. Question back there? No, they're identical to the other servers in the farm. We just purposefully choose not to put DMs on there except when we have a specific reason to do so. Yes? So the question was, did we fix or set a target for the specific number of machines we would have on each host and stick to that, or did we have some variability based on load? Is that your question? Yeah. The answer to the first question is we did not fix the number of machines. We had kind of a general target that we were shooting for. But we recognize that in some cases, especially in cases where maybe the workload had increased from the time that we did the initial analysis, we had to allocate more resources to that machine, and so we would compensate for that. So we have on average, we've achieved the consolidation ratio that we determined in the financial model, but if you look at a specific server, it may be above or below that. In terms of how that ties back to the financial model, at least for the financial analysis, since we achieved the average consolidation that we expected across the farm, we feel the financial analysis is still valid. As far as cost chargeback or scaling the amount of cost for the machine based on the resources it's using, that's something we're still working on. I expect that we will have a differentiated cost to some extent based on the resources that we apply. At this point, all of these early adopters, these original 117 machines and the machines that were migrated as part of this project, they kind of got a freebie. This was, the project was centrally funded and the base infrastructure put in place to support the initial migrations. So we have not charged that back to the application owners who, if you think about it, they had already purchased their original physical server. They certainly didn't want to pony up more money for a virtual machine, which they may or may not have wanted. So we thought it appropriate to kind of seed the environment, put the infrastructure in place, and then once we kind of have things stable and people are coming now with new server requests that in the old system they would have had to pay for a physical server, that's where it's reasonable to start to try to capture some funds to fund the enhancement or expansion of the ESX farm. Yes? The size of the team, at any given time, there were about three people from RapidApp on site, and then two primary people from AMD, with a number of other people supporting certain aspects of the project. Yes, sir. We work, we're big partners with HP, so we work pretty hard to have good, mutual relationships there. But we buy our HP servers. At least we IT buy the HP servers just like everybody else. A lot of people ask, hey, do you buy them without any processors and then go put them in yourself? Maybe the engineering guys would like to do that, but those of us who have to actually run the environment, we'd rather not be there kind of, gluing cooling compound onto the processors and mounting those in servers. We run the environment pretty much like any other customer would. Well, let me see. I go back to about six slides on that. Anything else? Yes, right here, and then I'll get to them back. Okay, let me see if I understand the question. Well, first of all, we don't do that. We have absolutely no Intel processors anywhere close to the AMD on AMD environment. So, you know, we have physical servers, old physical servers running Intel processors that we've migrated, but all the ESX servers will always have AMD processors. And did you have a question back in the back? It was really more load balanced, because if you think about the model for ESX, you know, what server it's running on, what server it happens to be running on today really doesn't matter that much. We might vMotion the machine to another box tomorrow for whatever reason. Plus, we're using the dynamic resource scheduler in a manual mode today. In other words, we look at its recommendations, and then we decide whether we want to act on them or not. So given the dynamics of that environment, we didn't think it made a lot of sense to try to say, this is our server for, you know, SAP, and this is our server for something else. That also goes to the philosophy that the ESX servers are simply commodities. You know, they are, you know, they're like a router or a switch or something like that, with minimal configuration on them, easily rebuilt, you know, nothing unique about them. Yes. Yeah, great. I'm sorry. Great point. And so that really goes back. So the question was, you know, how do you, it seems like if you're not careful, all of a sudden you're going to have a proliferation of virtual machines, and now you've got twice as many virtual machine images as you had physical server images before. And, you know, that gets into all the patching and operating system licensing problems and all that sort of thing. And again, I think that goes, that's not a technical problem. That is a business process or management problem, and it goes to having appropriate controls in place. Just because it's a virtual server doesn't mean that you can just come and ask for one and automatically get it. There are financial implications for deploying a virtual server. Just as it may be different, but there's still costs to deploying a virtual server. There are management implications. There are licensing implications. So there needs to be the same type of approval process for producing a virtual server as there is for a physical server, since you're allocating costs, you're allocating a license. So it may be that it's much easier to do it, and you can do it a lot faster, which is why it's all the more important to have those processes in place to manage those requests and make sure that there's some reasonable approval being done, so you don't just get virtual servers because people think it's cool. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Okay. Any other questions? So the question for, did we put all the hosts in the same farm? And would we architect it in the same way again if we were doing this from scratch? The answer to the first is, within each location, yes. With the exception of, I mentioned we had a small farm in the DMZ. That's a separate farm from our production farm. And the answer to the second one, at least from all of the experience that I have had, there's not anything significant in the design that I would change if I were doing this again. I think that, you know, if we were doing it today, the one difference is that we would probably look at some of the more full-featured management tools to support the P2V process, probably look at maybe some of the additional backup solutions that now support ESX 3.0, things like that. All those things we will be doing moving forward. But the fundamental design, we think, is very sound. It's certainly been very stable since we put it in place, and I can't think of why I would want to change it at this point. One other comment on that is that I would like to see us move more aggressively towards getting that DR data replication feature in place. And so that's the big enhancement that I want to see the design moving forward. Okay. Well, now it's time for me to arbitrarily award the processor in a box. And I will start by offering it to this gentleman up front who asked the first question of the presentation. If you would like it, you're welcome to it. You're very welcome.
I'll upgrade my 3400.
Yeah. Thank you all very much. Hope you have a great evening and enjoy the rest of VMworld.